thanks for joining us for this episode of New Books in Philosophy. I'm Robert Talese. I'm professor of philosophy at Vanderbilt University. I co-host the program with Carrie Figder. Carrie is associate professor of philosophy at the University of Iowa. My guest today is Candice Delmas. Candice is assistant professor of philosophy and political science at Northeastern University. She's a moral and political philosopher working on normative questions about political authority, citizenship, and obligation. Candice's new book is titled A Duty to Resist, When Disobedience Should Be Uncivil. It's published by Oxford University Press. Now, according to a long tradition in political philosophy, there are certain conditions under which citizens may rightly disobey a law enacted by even a legitimate political authority. That is, it's common for political philosophers to recognize the permissibility of what's come to be known as civil disobedience, even under broadly just political conditions. There are, of course, long-standing debates over how to distinguish civil from uncivil disobedience, what forms of civil disobedience are permissible, what kinds of acts disobedience may take, and the difference between civil disobedience and other kinds of principled lawbreaking, such as, for example, conscientious refusal. Yet the consensus seems to be that whenever disobedience is permissible, it must also be enacted within the constraints of civility. Now, in her book, Candice Delmas challenges this consensus. She develops an argument according to which the standard accounts of the general obligation to obey the law also would permit forms of principled lawbreaking that go beyond the standard constraints of civility. So there's a lot to talk about. But let's begin, as we normally do, with our guest. Hello, Candice.
Hello, Bob.
Why don't you get us started by telling us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. And thanks for inviting me. It's a real pleasure to be here.
Well, thank you for joining us.
So I'm originally from France. I grew up right outside Nice on the French Riviera. That did not prepare me very well for New England's winters, unfortunately. I fell into philosophy in high school, first by studying literature. I remember we read very philosophical texts like Jean-Jacques Rousseau and Voltaire, starting in around 10th grade. And then the next year, the curriculum for the French baccalaureate in literature included The Human Condition by André Malraux, The Fall by Albert Camus, and Life is a Dream by Pedro Calderon, and I still remember vividly that year. I found all these texts just fascinating, and I wanted to hear more about the philosophy that they were relying on and articulating. I loved poetry too, Baudelaire, Rimbaud, Verlaine, and their reflections on mortality, beauty, and art. I was also a fan of Stanley Kubrick and David Lynch, whose films I found beautiful and enigmatic. And so I just long to appreciate and understand all that even better with philosophy. And by this time, I started actually taking philosophy classes, which was in high school, 8 hours of it per week.
Wow.
I was hooked. I studied it as an undergrad in Paris and then in the U.S. in graduate school. So that's the thread of my interest in philosophy. And it didn't intersect with my interest in civil disobedience until I joined the PhD program. So I had been always fascinated by social movements and popular uprisings. I grew up at the end of the Cold War with the fall of the Berlin Wall and the rise of democratic independence movements throughout the Soviet Union. Protest is also, you know, central to France. It's in France's DNA. So we talk about the French Revolution, the Paris Commune, and May 1968 a lot. As a French youth, going to demonstrations is a bit of a rite of passage, and strikes regularly paralyze France. And all this had made me especially receptive to the U.S. tradition of principle disobedience, which I discovered in grad school thanks to my advisor, David Lyons. Mm. So we discussed and read about abolitionists in antebellum U.S., the boycotts and civil disobedience campaigns of the civil rights movement, the radical activism of black nationalists, the political violence of left-wing groups like the Weather Underground. And in contrast with this rich tradition and political significance of civil disobedience, I was surprised to see the philosophical focus on questions of obedience, mostly really. While, you know, thinking about civil disobedience is always narrowly confined and so doesn't come close to addressing the variety of disobedience I just mentioned. And really, principled disobedience, at least when I started studying, was relatively neglected in philosophy. So, yeah, that's how I got interested in civil disobedience.
That's fabulous. Can I just ask a question? You mentioned the Kubrick and David Lynch films. Were there any particular films by either of those filmmakers that you thought was especially philosophical?
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
I have an interest in film that many people don't know about.
Oh, really? Do you like those two directors in particular?
Yes, in particular I do, yeah.
Yeah, so I love the 2001, The Space Odyssey,
right.
And The Clockwork Orange, and some of the older films too. And, with Lynch, I loved Twin Peaks, actually, the TV show, and, Lost Highway, and yeah.
Yeah, there's some very deep thoughts about modal logic in Lost Highway. I could talk a long time about some of those films, but let's pick up with the book, which is really, really fabulous. So let me just start by congratulating you. I think you've written a really, really nice piece of philosophy here. So the book, which is titled The Duty to Resist, remember, begins with the idea that the very grounds that are offered typically in support of the duty to obey the law, those very reasons, those very arguments, those very grounds can be marshaled in support of an obligation to resist injustice. And then you argue very broadly now that this obligation may permit forms of principled disobedience that standard views of civil disobedience would deem impermissible. And you say that you were led to this kind of view by taking seriously not only the views of political activists, but the descriptions of the descriptions offered by political activists of what they were doing and what the justification was or is for what they were doing. Can you tell us a little bit about that background in particular?
Yes, sure. So there's a disconnect between, on the one hand, activists' practice of principled disobedience, resistance, their activism, their discourse around it, and on the other end, analytical philosophical theorizing about civil disobedience. So I want to talk about that disconnect first, and then I'll say a little more about the civil and civil distinction.
Okay.
So let me start with the theory. Philosophers who are concerned with the rights and duties of citizens often defend a moral duty to obey the law. The duty to obey the law requires obeying unjust law in nearly just legitimate states. And this has been standardly assumed even by champions of civil disobedience. So they will generally mount their defense of civil disobedience within that background of the duty to obey, and they will start with the understanding that with the notion that breaking the law is presumptively wrong and in need of justification given the duty to obey. There is also, so the equation of political obligation with the duty to obey, right? So that's really all we focus on. And I think that equation ignores the fact that under non-ideal conditions, like the ones we live under, obedience might not be our primary or most urgent political obligation. So part of the project is to expand the scope of political obligation to make it a plural thing, our political obligations, depending on the socio-political legal conditions we live under. So given this background, again, so returning to the theory, so champions of civil disobedience show that civil disobedience, given its narrow constraints, given certain justificatory conditions, such as it's being used as a last recourse against real injustice, really trying to minimize the disruption and so on, may be permissible despite its violating the duty to obey. So it's framed in terms of a permission or a right under narrow circumstances, given that the duty to obey. That's basically the theory, though there are exceptions. But and meanwhile, activists recognize and have always recognized principal disobedience and resistance to injustice as a responsibility, not merely an option to be chosen under the narrowest of circumstances. And so if you look at Henry David Thoreau, Mohandas Gandhi, and Martin Luther King Jr., who are the paragons of civil disobedience, even according to theorists, in their writings, in their speeches, they talk about non-cooperation with injustice as a moral duty or the duty to disobey unjust law, depending on the scope of the injustice, right? And so that's really the way activists have been thinking about it. Contemporary activists also think about it that way. So human rights organizations that provide a shelter to irregular migrants. In France, for instance, the Collectif Contre les Expulsions defends a moral duty of solidarity. Since the election of President Donald Trump in the U.S., activists from Black Lives Matter to Indivisible to the Center for Constitutional Rights urge us to recognize and fulfill our duty to resist, given the threat to democracy that President Trump represents. Again, Me Too and Time's Up recognize a duty to stand up and call out perpetrators of sexual abuse. So, and the list could go on, right? So I wanted to heed these calls from a theoretical, philosophical perspective, show that they were rightly framed resistance to injustice as a matter of duty and not as a permission. And I found that the traditional arguments for the moral duty to obey the law provided all we need to defend the duty to resist. And now on the civil and civil distinction, because I haven't said anything about it there, but so while theorists focus narrowly on civil disobedience, activists don't do that, but they don't really talk about uncivil. So let me say a little bit there.
Sure.
The standard conception of civil disobedience, so propounded by John Rawls, commonly endorsed by the public, is narrower than the principled disobedience that activists call for and that I think we should reflect on. So on the standard view, civil disobedience is a conscientious, public, nonviolent breach of law undertaken by an agent willing to accept punishment with the goal of persuading the majority to change a law or policy by appealing to the community's shared principles of justice. And so given all this, disobedience there is supposed to be undertaken within the limits of fidelity to law. That's why it can be permissible on these standard liberal accounts. So I identify four marks of civility from this standard view. One is publicity. So the disobedience must be open and communicative. It's designed to be read as a speech act by a given audience. The second is nonviolence, which prohibits the use of force, the infliction of harm and damage to property. Sometimes it also excludes coercion, but I don't think it should. So I don't take nonviolence to necessarily prohibit coercion. The third mark of civility is non-evasion, which just means that the agent accepts the legal consequences, so may not necessarily seek them out, but accept them when they come. And the fourth, which is implicit, I think, not explicitly stated in the philosophical definitions like Rawls's, is decorum. So the idea that the disobedience should conform with social norms of respectfulness and considerateness. Now, there's been a lot of critiques of the standard conception. And so theorists like Kimberly Brownlee and Rabin Selikates have redefined civil disobedience more broadly, so that they would include acts of principled disobedience that are covert, evasive, and even violent, basically so long as they remain communicative, even if they're not primarily communicative, but they should be basically communicative. So that's not the road I take, right? So they are undertaking an ameliorative project on civil disobedience, which should help make some historical or novel forms of protest that don't fit the standard account nonetheless acceptable, and to make them acceptable, stretching the label civil to include them seems like a good idea, a good way of doing that. But I see a couple of issues with this approach, which is why I wanted to think about incivility instead. So the first one is that it's just not very persuasive to the lay public and pundits and officials, etc., who are used to associating civil disobedience with the four marks of civility I just mentioned. So if you just declare that civil disobedience includes covert, violent, evasive acts of civil disobedience, people are like, well, that's not really what we're talking about. Mm-hmm. And the second problem is that a number of activists and dissidents, from the English suffragists to the activist group Anonymous, the radical feminist collectives Pussy Riot and Femen, openly and deliberately flout the standard script of civil disobedience. They usually do so because they want to make a point of refusing the system's legitimacy. And so rather than trying to shoehorn these acts into the category of civil disobedience, I wanted to grant their incivility and inquire into their possible justification. So just to finish, on my view on civil disobedience designates acts of principled disobedience that may or may not be communicative. So that includes direct action, and that violates one or more of the four norms or marks of civility by being covert, violent, evasive, or offensive. And given civil disobedience thus understood, I was trying to think about the potential instrumental or expressive value of acts like this.
Excellent. Let me just ask a sort of just a quick kind of conceptual question. If on your account, the thought is that a successful conception of civil disobedience, or maybe just principled lawbreaking, to use the more general term that you use, if a successful account of principled lawbreaking ought to accommodate or try to capture what political activists say that they're doing and what their commitments seem to be, and if part of what activists say they're doing often is that they are responding to a duty to not be complicit with injustice, to resist injustice, to do what they can to rectify injustice. Do we then wind up with a view, or does your view wind up taking a position where those who don't protest are blameworthy?
Yes, we
okay,
can.
Good. I thought so.
Yeah, I mean, we should talk about that after I have, I seek to convince you of the duty to resist based on all the grounds of, based on the four grounds standardly used to defend the duty to obey the law. But yes, I do think that people who do nothing are usually blameworthy.
Perfect. That's good. I just wanted to make sure that that was part of what was explicitly in the background of the discussion as we get into the meat of the book.
Can I say something about because I said you were going to ask me more about the successful theory of principal disobedience accounts for activists' own understanding of what it is they're doing. So yes, I take phenomenological accuracy to be one of the desiderata. But the theory is not exactly, is not really, is not entirely committed to it. So there are activists. So to take just one example, Edward Snowden insists in is engaged in civil disobedience, and I think he's wrong about that. That government whistleblowing is its own kind of principal disobedience, which violates some marks of civility, and that's okay. We can still justify it on its own terms, and that involves a different path than the standard justification of civil disobedience. So I think it's a kind of preliminary laying of the land that doesn't quite completely constrain the account.
Sure. Can I just one other methodological sort of question before we get into what I take to be the central line of argument in the book? And this is already sort of was touched on in part of what you were just saying. You know, it's always struck me as very puzzling in political philosophy that our conception of civil disobedience or the standard conceptions of civil disobedience still seem to be conceptions within ideal theory. And it's always sort of struck me as puzzling that civil disobedience is kind of intrinsically a non-ideal phenomenon, right? So can you tell us a little bit just about the relation? You mentioned this, discussed it early in the book, the sort of where you place yourself with respect to this longer tradition in political philosophy, which is mainly concerned with giving a fairly highly idealized conception of permissible disobedience. You're, I take it, more interested in pursuing the topic from the perspective of non-ideal conditions. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. Right. So theories of civil disobedience are supposed to be ostensibly non-ideal theories, right? So John Rawls presents it as an incursion into non-ideal theory, which is designed to help address real-world issues, presumably such as the anti-war student activism and civil rights protests of his time. But he thinks that civil disobedience is a problem only in the special case of the nearly just society.
Right.
So civil disobedience is only a problem there because of the moral duty to obey the law, which would make disobedience presumptively impermissible. It's not a problem in less than nearly just not quite legitimate and illegitimate societies where citizens are not morally bound to obey the law, because there disobedience does not presumptively require justification. So it's a very idealized non-ideal theory, as you just said. It's restricted to this ideal set of circumstances, idealized set of non-ideal circumstances. And it is not very helpful wherever society's legitimacy is in question, which is in the real world, really. So part of what I do in the book is describe the way the standard theory, despite being explicitly restricted to the nearly just society, has been applied to non-ideal political conditions like our societies, historically and at present, right? So even to talk about the kind of disobedience against Jim Crow, it was taken to be a good theory to apply there. And that has had the effect of imposing very demanding criteria on disobedience and in effect deterring resistance. So even though it was supposed to be this kind of progressive sort of theory to say there's a duty to obey the law, but there's room for civil disobedience because it's been applied to really less than nearly just circumstances. It has made for a really counter-resistance sort of ideological work really in the background there. Right. So that's my problems with the theory. But I should say I do take up the liberal challenge by situating my arguments for the duty to resist and the justification of uncivil disobedience within these nearly just supposedly legitimate societies. So I'm trying to convince liberals, even though we would probably disagree on the diagnosis of legitimacy, but I try to accept that take up the challenge that way. So yeah.
Right. So great. Let's then sort of pick up then the central thread of the argument, which is as you were just saying, willing to start with the standard accounts in more or less mainstream liberal political philosophy about why there's an obligation or why there's a presumptive obligation to obey the law. So the central argument, as I understand it, runs that these standard accounts of the duty to obey actually, when sort of just extended in fairly natural ways, support an obligation to resist injustice. And that obligation to resist injustice also lends itself to an argument that suggests that we are not merely permitted, but have a duty to engage in various kinds of principled lawbreaking, including uncivil disobedience, when the injustice of the laws, you know, reaches a certain degree of severity. So can we begin then where you yourself begin? So one purported ground for the duty to obey the law is sometimes just sort of the natural duty of justice theory. Can you tell us a little bit about how this natural duty account of the duty to obey can be extended into a duty to resist and then ultimately a duty to engage in principled lawbreaking?
Yes, sure. Yeah, I think that the natural duty of justice is the most widely embraced source of political obligation. So that's why I wanted to start there. According to Rawls, the duty of justice has two parts, right? It requires supporting just institutions by complying with those that exist and apply to us, and by assisting in the establishment of just arrangements when they do not exist. Right. When this can be done with little cost to ourselves. All right. So there are, since Rawls made the case for the duty to obey on the basis of the duty of justice, there's been many different kinds of accounts. But the structure of the arguments are similar. So for each account, the duty of justice both grounds and limits the duty to obey the law. And that's why there's some leeway for me. So each account contends that the natural duty of justice requires submitting to the state, but each places a limit on the duty to obey the law at the border of legitimate liberal democratic states. So all these duty of justice based accounts of the duty to obey are always tied to democratic legitimacy. Mm-hmm. And roughly, that's because, well, the duty of justice addresses individuals as free and equal citizens. And so it cannot obligate them to maintain legal and sociopolitical conditions that deny people that free and equal status. So on all these accounts, the duty to obey the law is limited, and injustice dissolves it. So that's where I start. And what I do is try to reach some clarity on the contours of the injustice by sketching a typology of the injustices that can and often do arise within broadly legitimate society. So it's not an exhaustive typology, but I take the injustices I identify to be fairly common in otherwise broadly legitimate society. So first there's disrespect, which consists of the public denial of citizens' free and equal status. An example would be anti-trans bathroom policy, such as in North Carolina, which attached bathroom access to the gender one is assigned at birth, or the burkini bans on the French Riviera. Second, wrongs to non-members. So that this injustice involves democratically sanctioned violations of the basic rights and dignity of non-citizens at home and abroad. So think of restrictive anti-immigration policies or unjust foreign military interventions. Next, deliberative inertia, which occurs when issues and discourses are blocked from the deliberative agenda. For instance, when it comes to environmental or animal rights issues or economic inequality. The fourth type of injustice is official misconduct, which consists in routine illegal practices by officials acting on their authority, think police brutality or political corruption. And the last one is public ignorance, which occurs when the state prevents the people from learning about conduct, programs, and policies that they should know and deliberate about. So these injustices are do not necessarily lead to a collapse of the state's legitimacy, but they partially weaken or dissolve the duty to obey the law, at least in those areas. And so where the duty of justice does not require obeying the law, as I think is the case in this context of injustice and democratic deficits, I want to argue that the duty of justice there permits and sometimes requires resisting injustice instead. It can when principled disobedience better advances justice than if you obey the law. So it isn't always the case, right, that principled disobedience would better advance justice, but in some cases it will. Or when it can serve to alert the public to the power differentials that threaten democratic legitimacy. So that's the argument for the duty to resist in its general form. Now, the final step of the argument identifies the methods through which this duty to resist based on the duty of justice can be satisfied. And so one is education. So that does not necessarily require educational initiatives. So to raise public awareness, to inform the public, to help advance a better understanding of democratic legitimacy or a better conception of justice. Educational initiatives don't need to be unlawful, but I look at some of the some activists campaigns and digital disobedience to raise awareness about digital rights and see them as in their way promoting the duty of justice and satisfying a duty to resist in context of deliberative inertia about digital rights. A second method is protest, which can include civil disobedience, and there I look at the civil rights movement as eager to change the community's conception of justice, so kind of tailored to enhancing the majority's understanding of what constitutional equality requires. The third method is covered disobedience. So the sanctuary movement, I think, is a good example of principled disobedience that realizes the duty of justice in context of so wrongs to non-members, right? I was talking about the restrictive anti-immigration policies. Then perhaps more surprisingly, vigilantism. So,
right.
Yeah. The idea there is that so vigilantism is usually most of the time impermissible because it consists of usurpation of the state powers, especially law enforcement powers, often for unjustifiable ends. But I was interested in groups like the Deacons for Defense, who during Jim Crow protected civil rights workers and the civil rights activists, and were patrolling neighborhoods to ensure the safety of people. So what they were doing was a kind of collective self-defense in context of institutional inefficacy and utter unwillingness to protect the bodily integrity and life of Blacks. So I take that as a kind of contribution to advancing the duty of justice in this particular context where, you know, with official misconduct in the background and disrespect front and center.
Right.
And the last one is whistleblowing. So I look at the Panama and Paradise Papers and Snowden's leaks and argue that they constitute justified worthwhile efforts to inform the public about things that should be known and deliberated about and put on the agenda important issues for the whole community to be discussing.
Right. So good. Now, one of the alternative views of political obligation is the sort of fair play arguments, right? The duty of fair play. So I take it that part of the strategy for the book is to take each of these standard accounts of political obligation and show how they can be easily extended to generate the duty to resist. Can you tell us a bit about how the duty of fair play can be marshaled in favor of the duty to resist?
Yes. So again, I start with the argument for the duty to obey. So with fair play, so the duty of fair play requires reciprocating for benefits received, doing one's share in producing mutual benefits. So fair play theorists of political obligation understand citizens as participants in a mutually beneficial cooperative scheme. What are these mutual benefits? Excuse me, that are produced by the cooperative scheme, benefits like stability, peace, rights protection, safe roads, and other public goods. So champions of political obligation on the basis of fair play say that you need citizens' compliance with the law. You need them to pay taxes and so on in order to provide all these public goods. And the cost of complying with the law is reasonable and fairly distributed. And so everyone is morally bound to do their part in sustaining the state. And because it's fair play, so the duty is owed to fellow citizens, right? And not to the state. And so it is met primarily, mainly really, yeah, through obedience to the law. Okay, so on all fair play accounts, participants are permitted to refuse to cooperate with exploitative or harmful schemes. So that's what I'm interested in, is what follows for citizens under conditions of injustice. And I look at schemes, social schemes that do not distribute benefits and burdens fairly, or that impose harms on non-members. Well, fair play theorists would say, well, nothing follows. Basically, yeah, you don't have to cooperate with unfair schemes because the duty of fair play is not going to be triggered because some of the conditions are missing. Or they might say it is nonetheless triggered if you consent to it, right? But the obligation to cooperate would be very weak and would be defeated. So either way, you can refuse to cooperate, even if you benefit, right? You can refuse cooperating with unjust schemes of coordination. But what I argue is that fairness doesn't just permit beneficiaries of unfair schemes to not cooperate. Fairness prohibits beneficiaries of unfair schemes to cooperate. And I call it the negative argument, and it rests on an analysis of fairness prohibition of free riding. So the idea is that benefiting from an exploitative or harmful scheme under certain conditions involves the same deontic wrong as free riding. So just as fairness prohibits free riding, so it prohibits benefiting from exploitative or harmful scheme because it involves the same wrong, that is objectionable arrogation of privileges or wrongful exploitation. So depending on how you cash out the wrongfulness of free riding, you might say what's wrong with it at its heart is that it's a kind of wrongful exploitation. Or you might say what's wrong is that you treat yourself differently. You gain some unearned benefits on the basis of others' compliance with the scheme. And so that's what's wrong. And so I argue that that's exactly what happens in these schemes when beneficiaries continue to cooperate. And so they need to cease benefiting from the unjust scheme of coordination.
Right. And so that, let me just ask you a quick question there. So that kind of argument, though, makes it seem as though the duty to resist might be more stringent in the case of the beneficiaries rather than the actual victims of the injustice.
Yeah, that's right. So in this chapter, the duty to resist on the basis of fair play only binds the beneficiary.
Right.
And all I have to say about victims comes at the end when I develop an argument for solidarity on the basis of fair play.
Right.
Which is supposed to apply both to beneficiaries and victims. And the idea is basically that, resistance itself should be seen as a social scheme with mutual benefits. And so you cannot free ride on others' resistance efforts, and that's why you have to join, whether you're a victim or a beneficiary.
Right.
But that's right. So the argument here only applies to the beneficiaries.
Fantastic.
So
I want to make sure that we cover the bases here because the arguments really are really intriguing. What about the Samaritan duty to obey the law? What about the Samaritan theories of political obligation?
Yeah, so they are a little less well known as accounts of the duty to obey the law, I think. So the Samaritan duty requires rescuing those in peril or dire need when one can do so at reasonable cost to oneself. Keith Wellman has articulated a Samaritan argument for the duty to obey. He argues that by achieving political stability, the state rescues everyone from the violence and chaos of the state of nature. And that's why it has the right to coerce me. So there's an account of legitimacy there first. If my compliance with the law is necessary to the state's Samaritan mission, then I have a Samaritan duty to comply with the law. But it doesn't exactly work so straightforwardly because, as a matter of fact, my compliance is not necessary, right? The state can function, achieve political stability, and succeed at its Samaritan mission, whether or not Contis Delmas obeys the law. So Wellman supplements the Samaritan account with non-consequentialist considerations of fairness. So we end up with the duty to obey is our fair share of the communal Samaritan chore of rescuing others from the peril of the state of nature. So that's the argument for the duty to obey the law. So my Samaritan arguments for obligations of disobedience and resistance go like this. So there's two of them. One is for a Samaritan duty to break laws that prohibit Samaritan rescue. And then there's a little more complex and general Samaritan political obligation of resistance. So the first argument is straightforward. The idea is this. If and when the Samaritan duty holds, it will hold even if fulfilling it forces an agent to break the law. So it's as straightforward as it sounds. If the state outlaws performance of the duty, citizens have a duty to disobey the law because that Samaritan duty will be much weightier than the presumptive duty to obey, right? That's the idea. So examples of laws that prohibit Samaritan rescue taken from the U.S. Context include the 1850 Fugitive Slave Law Act, which had some provisions on the that prohibited the concealing, harboring, shielding fugitive slaves. And more recently, unfortunately, some anti-immigration policies that also forbid assisting undocumented migrants. So Alabama, the law on the books for a while, it was then struck down by courts, but it also criminalized the concealing, harboring, shielding unauthorized aliens. France has also an immigration law like this that punishes anyone who facilitates or attempts to facilitate the illegal entry, movement, or residence of a foreigner in France. So that's the straightforward case for a Samaritan duty to disobey the law. Then the case for Samaritan civil disobedience, in that chapter, I actually don't say very much about uncivil disobedience, but I do try to say that there's general political obligations of resistance, including through civil disobedience. So it kind of extends the reasoning from the simple case to more complex situations. So I look at what I call persistent Samaritan perils, which involve cases where injustice generates enables or aggravates Samaritan perils, making them pervasive and frequent. So here the state, the society, doesn't just produce laws that prevent rescue, but it is structured in a way that generates the frequent occurrence of Samaritan perils. So in ways that are predictable given the law, right? So examples include Jim Crow, again, the racial caste system in the U.S., which induced persistent Samaritan peril by subjecting African Americans to conditions of extreme material deprivation, coercion, intimidation, and terror. And the violence against blacks there was routine and it was officially sanctioned, which is important also to make it a persistent Samaritan peril here. So there was an institutional failure to protect. There was the fact that police and officials were themselves actively involved in violence against African Americans. Other examples of persistent Samaritan perils include the American urban ghetto, which I think can be described as sources of persistent Samaritan perils, especially for young men and women. So given crime and the lack of good community policing, and of course given widespread police brutality. Refugees are under persistent Samaritan peril, so at home when they are forced into displacement, in their journeys in refugee camps, which are unsanitary, depressing places with alarmingly high levels of violence and suicide. I look at women in India who fear for their safety in public spaces and suffer a very high incidence of sexual assault. So I characterize these sociopolitical conditions as persistent Samaritan perils. Now, the next step in the argument is to say that citizens are passersby witnessing persistent Samaritan perils. And so what does Samaritan rescue look like for these citizen passersby? And I think that many citizens are passersby there, right? I think that they may be well positioned to fulfill the duty to rescue through reform. So the only way to really address persistent Samaritan perils is to eliminate the injustice at the root of the perils through reform. So right. So one thing they could do is just bystander intervention in each time a Samaritan peril arises. But that would not do anything to address the persistence of Samaritan perils. So the only way to address the latter is to radically reform the structures, the law, the practices that lead to generating, enabling, aggravating Samaritan perils. And so the last step is that the Samaritan duty can support obligations to call for reform given the Samaritan mission. And calling for reform can often be effectively done through principal disobedience. So that's the last step of the argument.
Right. Fabulous. Finally, the remaining sort of pillar on which the general duty to obey the law is often supported are what are called sort of associative or relational theories of political obligation. Now, you claim that these two can be shown to support a general duty to resist.
Yeah, so that's the associative theories. The argument in that chapter works a little bit differently because there are so many associativist arguments for political obligation that I can't really appeal to all of them. I say that because all the previous chapters really try to appeal to any champion of the given ground for the moral duty to obey the law. So I can't quite do that with associativist arguments because they're so diverse. But so there's conceptual arguments, identity arguments, and I look at value-driven arguments. So just to be really brief, so some associativist theorists hold that membership in a political community basically just conceptually entails political obligation, so I wasn't really interested in those kinds of arguments. Others hold that it's about the feeling of belonging, the feeling of identity that comes with political membership. So those who identify with the group they belong to are bound by its rules. And because they usually say, regardless of what these rules requires, I wasn't really interested in those arguments either. So the ones that I find the most compelling on their own terms as arguments for the duty to obey the law are those that ground political obligation in the value of political membership. So because of the character, usefulness, or the purpose of the relationship that members share. So I focus on one particular value-driven associativist account, and that's the one defended by the late Ronald Dworkin in Justice for Hedgehogs. And I think it offers a really attractive account of associative political obligation, in part because it draws on dignity, which is a really powerful concept with great currency in politics and law and philosophy. And so I hope that my arguments there appeal to both associativist theorists and champions of dignity. So briefly, Dworkin argues that so special obligations, like all the other moral requirements, are grounded in the overarching value of dignity. which governs and unifies ethics and morality, and really basically demands respecting humanity in all its forms. So dignity prohibits subordination, and it prohibits domination. And to him, political obligation derives from the internal character of political relationships that preserve dignity. So dignity forbids subordination, but it permits us to share our responsibility for our own lives with others, as we do in democracies. And when the deference is reciprocal, then we have a duty to obey the law of that association. So that's roughly the account. But Dworkin is attuned to, is sensitive to the problems of, I mean, political association is a risky relationship. We risk subordination, subservience in them. And so we have to be really careful and attentive to make sure that the relations of power always show reciprocal deference. So the question I address in that chapter is, okay, what does a person ourself and others in the face of a polity's failure to treat her or some others as an equal and valuable member, right? So that's the question. And the idea is that political membership in conjunction with the demands of dignity supports a general obligation to resist one's and others' violations of dignity. And so what the general obligation of resistance requires in specific circumstances depends on the kind and magnitude of the indignity threatened. It depends on the agent's abilities and opportunities and their particular position relative to the indignity. But what I do is examine four related purposes of resistance, which go some way to fleshing out how to satisfy the general obligation of resistance. And so one is rectification. You fix the flawed law, policy, institution through reform or revolution. A second is communication. So it's about publicly condemning the law, policy, institution, or system that threatens dignity. A third is assertion, so affirming one's dignity in the face of threats and denials of it. And the fourth is solidarity, so acting in and expressing cohesion with or among the oppressed. And so these goals are interrelated. Because, you know, asserting one's dignity and expressing solidarity are communicative acts, and communication is the first step toward rectification. But I found Dworkin's account really interesting because basically he tells us that the reasons you have to care about how your life goes are also reasons for you to care about other people's lives.
So
it requires everyone to resist violations of some members' dignity. And I found that really powerful. And in that chapter, I illustrated with prison protests, which I think are very interesting sites of injustice. And I look at a lot of uncivil disobedience here, from provisional IRAs, dirty protests and hunger strikes in Northern Ireland, to Attica and California hunger strikes against solitary confinement. So I try to look at a different sort of agents here with that chapter.
Yeah. So given that the argument tries to show that, and does a good job, I should say, of showing that the duty to resist follows from many of these sort of standard angles one might take in defending the general duty to obey the law. I guess there's one objection, and it's one that you're keen to address, is a kind of demandingness objection, right? One objection is that the view, your view, the view that there's a duty to resist, and sometimes resistance can take the form of uncivil disobedience, that this duty would impose on citizens fairly stringent demands to resist injustice by means of principled protest, including perhaps in some cases on civil law breaking. Can you tell us a little bit about how you deal with the demandingness worry?
Yeah, I don't think I deal with it very satisfyingly, I'm afraid. But here's what I have to say about it. First, I recognize the objection. So it's a really multi-layered objection. It's not just demandingness. It's the epistemic and moral uncertainty of our action in the world. So it is daunting to consider the extent of everything we might be required to do, especially if it doesn't stop at the merely legal, right? So right. How realistic is it to ask so much of ordinary citizens? And because, you know, political obligations of resistance are imperfect, so one has discretion as to whether and how to fulfill them. So you're kind of on your own, it seems, to figure out what your obligation to resist injustice requires you to do in particular context, how much it requires you to do. You must assess the moral merits of the law. You must evaluate their effects on people and on the integrity of the legal system. You must choose among different methods of resistance. So we may err at every step of the way. We may be mistaken about injustice and so on, and we may end up causing more harm than good. So it's not just demanding. It may be all things considered undesirable to ask citizens to do that. So my response, unsurprisingly, part of what I want to say is just that we shouldn't expect morality to be anything other than demanding in the non-ideal circumstances in which we live, which are often marred by injustice. Another response is that the duty to obey the law, which a lot of people accept, makes very burdensome demands on citizens. You have to pay taxes, sit on juries, be conscripted, and serve in the military in some cases. And so there's no reason political obligations in the face of injustice cannot be equally demanding. Another sort of response is that we have limited time and cognitive resources and financial resources. We have other valuable projects to pursue. This may mean that we cannot be expected to devote ourselves entirely to struggle for justice and democracy, but it certainly does not mean that we can just shrug off our political obligations as excessively demanding and do nothing, which is why I really think that you can be a blameworthy for inaction. And one thing I want to say too is that, so especially when it comes to the worry of just letting individuals be private judges of everything that's at stake here along the way of resisting injustice. So in the last chapter, I look at thinking and resistance as collective endeavors. So I use Hannah Arendt's and Michael Walzer's conceptions of civil disobedience as kind of group-centered practices. And I also use Amélie Rorty's analysis of ambivalence to argue that when we are pulled in different directions by what we feel are conflicting duties, or when we are trying to act on our obligations of resistance but are confused about the shape they should take, we should respond to these pulls, this confusion, with collaborative engagement. It's what we usually do, whether we think about it that way or not, but it's especially important, of course, in the realm of political action. And I think that if we reflect and deliberate together, we're more likely to get things right, just as if we resist together, we're more likely to achieve things. So that's the my response. Yeah.
Interesting. So, you've been, Candice, you've been very generous with your time, and so I want to thank you. Last question. What will you do next? What's this is a fabulous book. Are you off to write another one?
I've not started another Booklands project. So I'm working on a couple of articles now. One is I'm continuing to think about civility and incivility. I'm writing an entry for the Cambridge Companion to Civil Disobedience, and I want to examine in great detail theories of civility. So outside the literature on civil disobedience, really see the best arguments one can find for civility and against incivility. And the other is a project provisionally called Disobedience from the Margins, where I look at dissident voices and disobedient practices from undocumented migrants, stateless people, and prisoners who engage in self-destructive disobedience like hunger strikes and lip suing, and see whether examining those practices tell us something more about citizenship, political action, and the forms of principal disobedience.
Well, Candice, that's all sounds fabulous, and a very nice series of issues that are stemming out of the book that you've written, which I for one found really, really stimulating. I want to thank you for your time today, for joining
thank
us.
You, Bob. I really enjoyed it.
Oh, that's fabulous. I enjoyed it too. And thank you, listeners, for joining us for our discussion today. We were discussing Candice Delmas's new book, A Duty to Resist When Disobedience Should Be Uncivil. The book is published by Oxford University Press. It's just out now. Thank you for tuning in, and bye for now.